Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an overview of the tormented Middle East as turmoil in Egypt continues and a possibly disastrous endgame involving the use of weapons of mass destruction in Syria looms. Egyptian-born veteran New York Times and Wall Street Journal Middle East correspondent Yusuf Ibrahim joins us to discuss the demise of democracy and the rise of fundamentalism as the Arab Spring is now being referred to as the Arab Winter. Then we go to Palestine and talk with Mark Danner, who is a journalist and professor and a longtime writer for The New Yorker and The New York Review of Books, where he has an article in the last issue, The Politics of Fear, and an article in the latest issue, How and What Obama Won. We will discuss the triumphant return of the Hamas leader to Gaza and the upcoming reconciliation talks with Hamas and the Palestinian Authority. Then finally, we'll speak with Ann Peterman, who is the executive director of the Global Justice Ecology Project, who has been attending UN climate conferences since 2004, but was banned from the UN climate conference in Doha that just ended. We will discuss the scant progress made where the Kyoto protocols were extended to 2020, but no reduction in greenhouse gases was agreed to, in spite of the desperate pleas from the island nations who are disappearing as a result of global warming. And joining us now is Yusuf Ibrahim, who is a columnist and political risk consultant. He served for 18 years as senior regional Middle East correspondent for The New York Times and 6 years as energy editor for The Wall Street Journal. Welcome to Background Briefing, Yusuf Ibrahim.
Hi, good afternoon.
And Yusuf, you're in touch with Egypt, obviously, and you've been there recently. But of course, when you go there, they give you a hard time, don't they, the immigration authorities?
Well, for the longest time, the previous regime basically gave me a very hard time. A hard time means you got to go wait for 2 hours until three separate organizations at the airport check you out. But I suspect the new regime eventually is going to give all of us who categorize themselves as liberal thinkers or liberals in general a much harder time. They're already giving a very hard time to the Egyptian people.
And it looks like Morsi, in reversing himself on his power grab decrees, is nevertheless sticking to insisting on this referendum on December 15. Now, what's disturbing about it is that the liberal secular opposition that you clearly would sympathize with, Yusuf, they're going to boycott, at least they're threatening to boycott the vote, and that will mean that the Muslim Brotherhood will vote in lockstep and the new constitution will go into play. I mean, isn't that political suicide?
Which is pretty much what happened the last time, as a matter of fact. I mean, we got to keep things in perspective. Morsi won by 51 to 49. That's well within the margin of error, but in the next referendum, the Muslim Brotherhood, to begin with, will have actual control of the government, so they will have a more active presence at the voting stations that's beyond simply opening a voting station, but perhaps manipulating the vote, which is the fear of the liberals anyway, or their suspicions, whether they are right or wrong. I tend to think they probably are right. Secondly, which means they concluded there's no way they're going to win anyway. However, your question is a very elegant question. Is the answer to boycott and therefore surrender? There is no question. You have to think about this, and they are thinking. Among the Egyptian opposition front, which has now united, which is, from their point of view, of course, a good thing. From the point of view of the Islamists, it is an outside conspiracy, as always. And they have united around the view that no matter what Morsi says, he has broken all the promises before. The Muslim Brotherhood had said it would never run a person for president in a trend Morsi. It has said it would never control more than 30% of parliament, and it went for 70% of parliament. So basically, the credibility of the Muslim Brotherhood with the Egyptian population is diminishing. The violence and the clashes have further diminished this. And we are standing on the verge of an irreconcilable conflict between two wings of Egyptian society. The surprise in this, Ian, is we just didn't know there were that many liberals in Egypt. It's absolutely amazing. We always assumed that only the Muslim Brotherhood had a militia, had an underground organization, because they've been working on it for 60 years. And suddenly we are discovering that many secular Muslims, not to mention some 10 to 12 million Christians, not to mention other minorities in Egypt, liberal thinkers and writers and the artistic community, et cetera, are also a large number.
Well, the other factor, though, in terms of the conservative Islamist bloc in Egypt, there is, of course, this other factor which came out of nowhere in the parliamentary elections, and that's the Salafist groups. That was largely funded by Saudi Arabia. And one of the things that I find extraordinary here is that you have, as we get towards an end game in Syria that could turn extremely bloody and may even involve the uses of chemical weapons of mass destruction. We don't quite know how that's going to end, but it is a proxy war between Saudi Arabia, this peculiar hybrid of a kleptocracy and a theocracy that have influenced Egyptian politics for the worst. And they're up against the Iranian theocracy, which is a kind of hybrid of a theocracy and a military and intelligence dictatorship. They're flying arms into Syria around the clock as the opposition, the Free Syrian Army, move in on the airport to try and stop them. So I see this whole region being torn apart by these two malignant powers, the Iranians and the Saudi Arabians.
Yeah, it's a little bit like dancing in panic over a hot tin roof that's getting hotter and hotter, or choosing to jump off the building and die anyway. And that's basically where the entire Arab world seems to be today. There is a collection of countries, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, but most especially the tiny emirate of Qatar and Kuwait, who are actually funding the Islamist forces in the Arab world. It's reminiscent in many ways of what we, the United States of America, did back in Afghanistan, back during the, or immediately after the beginning of the Soviet invasion. We picked these people who became eventually the Taliban. We trained them. They were illiterate. They didn't know anything. They were fighting with Lee Enfield, World War I rifles, and we transformed them into an insurgency that was so effective it killed maybe 40,000 Russians and kicked the Russians out. However, in the end of the day, they were only faithful to what they believed, which was an extremist form of Islam, and they turned against us, against the Americans. Now, they are in the process of killing as many Americans as possible, and when the Americans leave, they will take over the country. So the Saudis, especially, and the Qataris, these are the two main bankers for the Islamist movement, are not appreciating the fact that the Islamist movement is an opportunist political organization. It is not a religious organization. It's essentially a group of parties and people and forces who are using Islam as a gateway, a door into power. And it believes really in one vote, one time, forever. So basically, they will turn against those who are being funded, eventually will turn their struggle against the Saudis. For example, in Syria today, the force that is rising is Islamic fundamentalist. It is the Muslim Brotherhood. In Tunisia, which led the Arab Spring, Al-Nahda Party, which is the extreme Islamist party there, claimed in the beginning that it will stay out of the election. Right now, it is pretty much taken over all the political forces and is struggling to take more. In Egypt, we see, of course, that the Muslim Brotherhood turned out to spread their wings far beyond where they said they were going to keep them. In Sudan, we've had an Islamist president for 30 years who's opened the country to Osama bin Laden, to other Islamist groups to train. And in Syria, as I said, the Muslim Brotherhood is in the lead. and has chemical weapons or is trying to obtain those chemical weapons, which will be a game changer. And finally, in Libya, you know, they just killed the American ambassador and three other diplomats, and the country is in total chaos with mostly Islamic groups. So basically, we have one big headline here. What is political Islam? Political Islam is Islamism, as we have come to call it. It's kind of the new communism. It's a new ideological political movement. It is not a religious reformist movement in any form or shape. It has no respect for the rights of individuals and certainly no respect for the rights of women. Now, you have in the middle of this salad, this mix, you have Iran and Iraq, too, who fought an 8-year war, and this war ended up with the creation of a Shiite arc. That's what the King of Jordan coined that phrase. And the Shia, as opposed to Sunni Muslims, is a formidable force on its own. But with two countries the size of Iran and Iraq, Iran's 80 million people run by mullahs, it is a theocracy, and Iraq, a country of a vast majority of Shiites, although not run by a theocracy, pretty sympathetic, combating all the other forces. They are anti-American, and they are, above all, anti-Sunni. So you have this huge cocktail blender here, which is running at medium to full force now. And the truth is, we don't really know what's going to come out of this, but we do know that it's taken already 2 years. We do know that it has destroyed any hope of true democracy in those countries of the Arab Spring. And we do know that it's becoming very bloody in different degrees. In Syria, 40,000 people have been killed already. During the Iraq-Iran War from 1980 to 88, 1 million Muslims were killed by other Muslims. So basically, there is a huge war within Islam, which is spilling over to affect other countries and eventually is uniting in a general rejection of modernization and Western values. So I'd say we are at a historic moment. I don't think any of us who, you know, is 50 years or older has ever imagined that the Middle East would turn this way. And everybody who was 50 years or younger had never even seen anything that resembles democracy. I mean, so they're moving from one autocracy of army officers and generals to another autocracy of imams, sheikhs, and the bearded ones.
Again, I'm speaking with Yusuf Ibrahim, who is a columnist and political risk consultant. He served for 18 years as senior regional Middle East correspondent for the New York Times and 6 years as energy editor for the Wall Street Journal. So this deadly cocktail that you're talking about in the region, Yusuf Ibrahim, is certainly coming to a head in Syria as we speak, where the Free Syrian Army, and because the U.S., I think, has been unsure, they haven't been sure of what to do, but they've been sure of what they don't want to happen, but they haven't been clear about what they want to happen. So the Saudis and the Qataris, again, it's difficult to know whether it's official state policy or whether just a bunch of independent wealthy princes are giving money to the Islamists. But we pretty much, it looks a bit like Jihad-EU, a jihadi university there in terms of who the Free Syrian Army are, even though the Syrian people are very secular from my understanding. And then you got the Iranians flying in around the clock, and I believe they've even got the Quds people and the IRGC people on the ground helping Assad fight the Free Syrian Army. It's all coming to a head over the airport in Damascus. What's your expectation of this, also this sword of Damocles that's involved here? This, I think, what is it, over 1,000 tons of sarin and mustard and other nerve gases.
Yes, and guess who is the most worried party of all this? Is the one party I neglected to mention, but is actually the main party in this game, is Israel. Because in the end of the day, if all of these people, the Sunnis, the Shiites, the Jihadists, the Saudis, the the Qataris agree on is that they hate Jews. And the Hamas leader gave a major speech in Gaza yesterday that reminded us that we were back all the way back in the 1970s or 60s, calling for the complete liberation of all of Palestine and Jerusalem and Tel Aviv and so on and so forth. So basically the ascent of radicalism among radical forces is like a genie that has gone out of the bottle now. We spent the last 20 years, we, the United States of America, spent the last 30 years or even more since the Carter administration, trying to ensure and nail down and affirm the basis of an Arab-Israeli peace anchored around the main states that were involved in the conflict, meaning Egypt, which signed the peace treaty with Israel under our sponsorship, and Jordan, which again, under American sponsorship, signed a peace treaty. Syria simply accepted a peace treaty without saying it's a peace treaty, and not a single shot was ever directed from Syria towards Israel for 40 years since the Israelis occupied the Golan Heights. So basically, that structure for us, the United States of America, is the only vital interest we have in that region. Of course, the other vital interest is oil. But as you know, and everybody has been reading lately, we are liberating ourselves increasingly from the need of importing oil from the Middle East. We're discovering tons of natural gas in this country, and Canada is a gusher in terms of oil. And the United States basically is close to the point where oil from the Middle East is no longer a vital interest. But the peace treaty with Israel and the safety of Israel is a vital interest. And where the Obama administration stands on this is exactly what you said. I don't think they know what to do. They know what not to do, which is Obama does not want to get into another war. But you can say these things, and in the end, you have to remember the experience we had in Rwanda. I mean, Clinton sat there and watched a massacre, a genocide, and at the end, he acted. Same thing in Bosnia. America just, you know, cannot, is a superpower. It is the superpower. It cannot stand and watch a massacre expanding in scale without acting. The question is, why don't we have a plan? Why doesn't the National Security Council sit down and work something out? Why are we not hearing that some kind of plan is being prepared? Not a war necessarily, but how to limit the damage, to re-clarify our relationship with Israel, because it's entirely possible that Israel will, the next time it is showered with rockets, will invade Gaza, especially that Hamas now is talking openly about eliminating Israel from existence. So a war is coming. What war? We don't know. It could be the implosion of Syria, which becomes the new Libya with a bunch of crazy militias running around, most of them Islamists with weapons, endless supplies of weapons, drawing the Iraqis in to fight with the Shia against the Sunni. Libya, God knows where this is going. And there are still countries that are in the balance, i.e. Algeria and Morocco. We don't really know which way they are going to be affected by all this. We are looking at a general area that's in flames. I don't know that we can put out the fire, but at least we should have a plan to contain it.
Well, just in closing, then, Yusuf Ibrahim, is there a possibility that in desperation, as the Free Syrian Army closes in on the Assads and the Alawites, is it possible that the Assads will fire their Scud, their chemical-tipped Scud missiles at Israel like Saddam did in the Gulf War?
I think it's a very strong possibility, and that's basically, the follow-up of what I was saying just before. Once this happens, Ian, all bets are off, because the Israelis, do not have but two options. They can accept to be obliterated or deeply, deeply wounded with these chemical weapons. You know, we're talking about serious weapons here. They're much bigger in impact, in real impact, than Hiroshima and Nagasaki atomic bomb in terms of their impact. How many people will be diseased, will be infected, will die? We're talking about hundreds of thousands of people if the Syrians went crazy. That the Syrians are going to go crazy is a safe bet. I would bet my money on that. The man has completely lost any hope of prevailing, that's Bashar al-Assad, and in the same time is losing any opportunity of getting out safely. So basically we are heading there for a no-return revenge. He's killed far too many people to be forgiven or allowed a safe exit. I don't think even the Russians can continue to support him. So it is entirely possible that Bashar al-Assad will unlock the key to not an atomic war, but something pretty close to that in the Middle East.
Well, Yusuf Ibrahim, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Yusuf Ibrahim, who is a columnist and political risk consultant. He served for 18 years as senior regional Middle East correspondent for The New York Times and 6 years as energy editor for The Wall Street Journal. We're going to take a brief station break and back and go to Palestine and talk with Mark Danner.
This is the end, my only friend, the end of our elaborate plans, the end of